Blog Talk Radio.
Carol the Coach. Sex, love, and relationships. We talk about it here.
Carol the Coach. Compassion with contemporary relevance.
I am a psychotherapist. I can be your personal life coach, and I can help you with your issues. There are no problems too small or too big. You can talk about anything.
Speaker, columnist, radio TV host, and commentator. Carol the Coach brings messages of wellness and empowerment within reach of everyday people every day.
Almost 5 years ago, I lost my soulmate in an accident. He was killed in a plane crash. Life just for me has seemed to stop.
There are groups all over the city. I mean, I teach one. It is a specific way to start thinking so that you shift how you see the world, which then shifts your energy, and then you feel better and you actually see things differently.
Carol the Coach. Always available to at carolthecoach.com.
Now, I've got Russell on the line.
I'm 47 years old. I'm a truck driver. I'm married. I have a wife in San Francisco.
Okay.
I haven't been home in 6 months. My thing is, I don't know if I have a sex addiction or what the problem is. Why do I want what I can't have? And as soon as I can have it, I don't want it anymore.
You're right on target when you say, I don't know if I have a sexual addiction. Well, guess what? Yes, you do. And you know what? That's my specialty, Russell. So you're at the right place. Continue.
I meet women online, and I'm in a different part of the country. I travel all 48 states, so I love sex.
I hear self-esteem issues. You never felt good enough, and you didn't feel like you were getting what you should have then, and you're reenacting that now. Do you want to change that about yourself?
And you know, this is Carol the Coach, and welcome to Strength, Hope, and Recovery. It's Sex Addiction and Sex Help with Carol the Coach. I am so happy to be with you tonight, and this is a show that's dedicated to people who have sexual addictions, both men and women, and their spouses, their partners, their loved ones. We talk about everything here. And so if you're listening to this show for the first time, I want to give you a number. It is a number that you can call in and ask questions if you so desire. That number is 646-595-3284. And I cannot highlight enough how important it is to talk about this subject with people who absolutely have been trained in the field of sexual addictions. I am a certified sexual addictions therapist. There are over 1,500 of us in the world, and you can go to www.iitap.com and find out who is available in your area that can help you face-to-face. And if you can't get help because there's nobody within a 200, 300-mile radius, there are many of us that will do Skype to get you to the places that you need to go. We act as consult services. You know, it wouldn't be ethical for us to do therapy online, but we certainly can do consultation. And that means that we can get you to the right meetings because there are telemeetings all over the world. If you've got a cell phone or a landline, you can get the help that you need. There are books available. I call it bibliotherapy. You can get information about books that truly make a difference in your life. And that's what we're here for. We're here to serve in all sorts of ways. And I know I've gotten many, many, many emails from people that have found me on iTunes. If you want to download the shows that we've been doing since March of 2012, you can go to iTunes, Google either sex addiction, or you can put in Hope, Strength, and Recovery, sex addiction, or sex help with Carol the Coach, and download all the podcasts. They are free, and they are a service to you to give you information about what you may need to know. You know, there are so many brave people that come on this show. They are either guests who have experienced sexual addictions, or they are guests who have loved somebody with a sexual addiction. And tonight we have a woman who has been struggling with this with her husband, and she actually had sent me, oh gosh, about 10 questions that she wanted answered. And so what I did was I answered them, and you can check out my answers on themeadows.com, the blog, a.k.a. Carol the Coach. And I thought tonight we could talk about those things because they were fantastic questions that so many partners have about their partners. And, you know, what do you do when you love somebody who has a sexual addiction? He or she has hurt you insurmountably over and over and over again. And, you know, I think the question becomes, do I stay with this person or do I leave? Do I talk about it or do I deal with it on my own? And, of course, I would highly recommend anybody who has questions should always find people that are trained in this field. And when I say trained in the field, I really encourage you to get certified sexual addiction therapists who have been trained that know what this process is like. And I also encourage you to do some reading. You know, Mending a Shattered Heart, A Guide for Partners of Sex Addicts by Stephanie Carnes is in its second edition. And in that book, it is an amazing book with questions and answers. For instance, you know, who do you talk to? When you find out, when you've experienced something called discovery, when you have found out through cell phone numbers, through overhearing conversations, from somebody calling the house and telling you that your husband or wife has had affairs, multiple affairs, is seeing prostitutes, has exposed him or herself, you know, who do you talk to about that? Well, of course I expect you to talk to trained professionals, but then the question becomes, who can I talk to in my immediate environment? Do I talk to my family? Can I talk to my sister? Can I talk to my mother, my mother-in-law? You know, my father-in-law? Who do I go to for this kind of help? And boy, that is an individual question that requires an individual response. You know, first, I would ask you, as I do any partner who loves an addict, I would ask you, what's your motivation? I mean, do you need to talk to somebody? Is there somebody in your life that you 100% believe can hold your confidence? You know, how much do you want to share? We always encourage people not to share the gory details, but to share the basic premise of the betrayal until you are absolutely and 100% sure that that person is going to hold your confidence, because clearly you don't want to create more drama in your life that will humiliate and embarrass you. So first I ask, okay, what's your motive? And when you can answer that, because I got to tell you, for a lot of partners, the motive is to hurt the addict. You know, the partner, the spouse has been hurt, and now it's time to retaliate. And that's never a good reason to share information with loved ones. You should want to share information because you need the support. And I, as I indicated, a certified sexual addictions therapist is the person to go to. As well as there are wonderful groups for members, for loved ones of addicts called COSA, and they're all over the country. That's a great resource. And, you know, I have met addicts and their wives or husbands that said, oh, our COSA group isn't very good. You know, there's a lot of drama in our COSA group, or they give bad advice in COSA. Well, that's always a possibility. Whenever you have people in a situation together, that may be the case. But I got to tell you, in my experience, COSA members are people that will have you focused on yourself. And whenever you go back to pointing your finger at you and deciding what is it that you need and what would be most helpful for you long term, you come up with great information, you know. Even though you may be angry and you may want to hurt your partner, is that really going to be to your own benefit down the road? Probably not. So you need somebody to process the anger, but what you really need is good information about how do you take care of yourself during this kind of crisis. And once the crisis is over, what do you do to maintain self-care and self-nurturance? And that's why we have a guest on tonight who has been brave enough to want to talk about her issues and her questions. And, you know, it was interesting because when she sent me these 10 questions, actually there were 11 questions, she even had questions about my responses. And I said, you know what, why don't you call the show? Let's dialogue about this, because I'm sure if you're asking the questions, there are thousands of people out there that also are asking the same questions. So again, if you're listening to the show and you want to respond, that number is 646-595-3284. And you can always email me at carolthecoach@aol.com or go to my website, which is Sex Help with Carol the Coach, and read about the different resources that are available, read about the different responses. I've got my clients that have contributed to this website so that you can see how do people really feel about their sexual addiction or their recovery from sex addiction or their loved one who has sexual addiction. So tonight we're going to be answering some all-important questions. Things like, how can a sex addict supposedly love their family and yet do what they do? Or is it okay to do that? Well, we know that it's not okay, but why does the addict think it may be okay? Well, I got news for you. The addict doesn't think it's okay, but we'll go into more detail when she joins us on the call. And then, you know, I've often said addicts either have habit disorders. They've got this obsessive compulsive drive that came from a brain lock, if you will, or they've experienced trauma. And so she asks a very important question, and that is, even if something happened as a child, doesn't the addict realize that it's wrong? And why would they continue to act out as opposed to doing the right thing in their lives? You know, she asked, why aren't they mindful? How can they continue to hurt us? She wonders, can an addict feel their feelings? Is there a sense of entitlement? Why do they seem so selfish? Is there always bullying and anger in the picture? Is sexual addiction immoral? What happens if it's illegal? And then even in recovery, why do addicts have so much trouble being intimate? And why can they not be intimate with their families? So as you can see, these are great questions that the normal spouse of an addict is feeling. And so again, if you want to read my blog, you can go to www.themeadows.com, look my name up, Carol the Coach or Carol Jorgensen Sheets. And then in the meantime, we're going to be talking with this woman who came up with such great questions, and she's going to be asking me not only these questions, but she's going to be challenging me based on my answers. Because, you know, it's one thing to hear from a therapist and to hear what the right answers are. But let's face it, these answers can be really raw. And it still triggers all that pain and loss deep inside of the spouse who's trying to work through the feelings, trying to figure out what's in his or her best interest for not only the person, but for the family as well. So again, these are tough questions, and I feel like whenever you open up communication, you really do gain power from the information. So I really am excited to be talking with her. And welcome to the show. Thank you so much for contributing as much as you have, both in your timely questions and then the fact that you're on the phone ready to dialogue with me about it. So I applaud you for your courage.
Well, good evening, and thank you for having me here this evening.
Yeah, it was interesting because I thought, now how should I refer to you? You know, this is an anonymous situation. Addicts are anonymous. They don't have to give their names. So what should I call you tonight?
That's a good question. I have many names. I've been called all kinds of things. you may call me by my first name. That'll be fine.
Okay. So, Charlotte, you've been through so much. And, you know, as I wrote up some information about you and I put it on Facebook and I put it on the radio blog itself, I realized that you've been going through this for years and years and years, but how long have you actually been dealing with it when you knew what to call it, when you knew that it was sexual addiction?
Oh, golly, about, that's a good question. I guess when I filed for divorce.
Okay.
So, and that's been about 18, 19 months ago.
Okay. Well, I know in working with you that, you know, you've been struggling with these behaviors for 5 years actively, but
yes. But
it's really gone longer than that. You had lots of questions about it prior to, and, you know, you had probably the best question ever asked to me when you said, how can a sex addict supposedly love their family and yet do what they do? So I kind of talked about the fact that in sexual addiction, they compartmentalize their feelings, and they do love you, and they do love their family, and they do want to do right, but there's this part of them that acts out, and the more they act out, the more they feel shame, and the more they feel shame, the more they act out. And you were having trouble with that answer, were you not?
Yes.
So,
yes, and that's what I wanted to talk about in your response to question number one, is when someone has a sexual addiction, they compartmentalize or categorize the feelings and behaviors and thoughts. And so what exactly do you mean by that, and explain it?
Well, what I mean is that they are able actually to love you and their family and to want to be a family man or woman. And then the minute you walk out the door or the minute that they are in isolation, that addict takes over and encourages them, that's the compartmentalized part of them, to meet their urges, to self-soothe, to self-medicate their needs by acting out. And so when an addict is in full-blown addiction, they're not thinking about anything but themselves. And I know that that seems very selfish, and it is, because anytime we think only about ourselves and not about our loved ones, our community, our environment, it's not really a reality. And so you have watched this happen over and over and over again. And if I could, I wanted to ask you a couple of questions. Do you believe that your husband loves you?
Yes.
Okay. So you believe your husband loves you, and yet your husband has had a history of doing lots of unhealthy things.
Yes.
And so in your own mind, how have you dealt with this? You know, how have you intellectualized it, if you will? How have you tried to understand the craziness of a man loving you and still making immoral, wrong decisions?
Well, I feel like I'm a strong lady, and I never thought that it was, I thought it was his problem and not mine, and he was going to have to fix it himself, that I couldn't fix it. And that it, if there was we could find out that he was a sex addict. But anyway, and that it's not my fault for the choices that he made.
And you're 100% right. I mean, that is a healthy, healthy way of looking at things, that A, it really has nothing to do with you. I know a lot of women, when they find out that their husbands are addicts and maybe have been with somebody else or have been looking at porn or chatting on chat lines, they kind of want to ramp up their sex life. You know, they feel like, well, maybe if my sex life had been better, my husband wouldn't have done this. But we have found that there's absolutely no correlation with that at all. It has nothing to do with the wife. It has to do with the addict's choices and perhaps their own childhood.
Mm-hmm.
And so oftentimes as a therapist, we look at what trauma has occurred in an addict's life that they may be reenacting in their adulthood. It doesn't make it right, but it just is an explanation so that we can get to the root of the problem and see if we can't cure it. It's the same with rapists or murderers or anybody that's done something horrific. I don't know about you, but when they try to use the defense that, you know, a rapist had been sexually molested, I say to myself, I don't care. You know, that's still no excuse for an adult taking advantage of a small child. There's no excuse for that. It may be a reason that's contributed to that impulse, but there's no excuse for the behavior. And that's how I feel with trauma reenactment. It helps us to go to the place with that addict to help him or her heal, but it's still not an excuse for unhealthy behavior. And so your husband has had in the past many, many bouts of unhealthy behavior. And you're probably right in the midst of deciding, do I stay or do I go?
Mm-hmm. Well, my third question, of course, was even if something happened to him as a child, why can they not realize a wrong and make it right in their own lives? And that's how we learn for ourselves and grow.
Well, I 100% agree with you. And that is actually what good therapy and men's groups and 12-step groups do, is that it holds the addict responsible and accountable, and it really has a mechanism by which it teaches men and women how to have empathy and how to, anytime that they feel that urge, they're supposed to default to, now, how would this make my partner feel if I got online and looked at porn? Or how would this make me feel about myself if I went and visited a prostitute, or I exposed myself, or I peeped in windows? You know, depending on whatever the sexual addiction is, that person needs some empathy skills to remember how it affects not only themselves, but also their loved ones. So when you ask that question, you know, even if something happened as a child, can they not realize a wrong and make it right in their own lives? Yes, they can, and they do, and that's what recovery is all about. But it does take the proper support. And is your husband in a support group?
Yes.
Okay. And typically when somebody is new to the program and they're in 12-step recovery, they're asked to go many times a week. Does your husband go to recovery groups many times a week?
Yes.
Okay. Now, I know, because I've known your husband, that when he originally came out with the problem and admitted that he did have a problem, he kind of fought it. Wouldn't you agree? The first time around?
Definitely.
Mm-hmm. And how many weeks? Yeah, I was going to say, how many weeks or months went by before he figured out, oh my gosh, I got to cut through this denial and admit this is a huge problem?
It was about 6 months.
Okay. And do you remember when he admitted that he had a serious problem, what were some of the things that I asked him to do?
Oh, I haven't. Well,
How many meetings did I ask him to go to?
Oh, I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know, but probably as many as he could.
Yes, I actually said, hey, I want you to go to 90 meetings in 90 days. That means a meeting every day for 3 months. And do you remember what literature I wanted him to read?
Well, it was Patrick Carnes.
Yeah, it was his Recovery Start Kit. Because that has not only psychoeducational information that I think every addict needs to read, but it also has him dialoguing with his addict every day, because that addict is there. Even when they want to be in recovery, that addict is trying to talk him out of it. I mean, most people in recovery are not perfect, and they slip, and they make mistakes. And so if you dialogue with the addict, you have more of a chance of actually fighting the impulses of that other part of you. And that was about how many months ago that he came clean and really started working a program?
I'm sorry, he came clean and did what?
And really started to work a program.
Oh, golly. It's been probably a year and maybe 6 months.
Yeah, I agree. It was right around that 18-month mark. And you know, there's no doubt that you have had extreme pain during that time, because as with most partners, there is that tendency to want to know everything and to finally want the truth. And you did deserve the truth. There's no doubt about it. As a partner of a sex addict, you already discovered the problem. Now you just deserve disclosure. And
I need so full disclosure, because I think it's necessary for the spouse and or the partner to safeguard the health of themselves and their family members.
I 100% agree with you. Although I really believe that you need to do that within the constraints of a lot of support. You know, I believe that you should have somebody there for support when you're hearing this stuff. He should have somebody there for support. You should have somebody who knows this information. I mean, that might have been a great time to say, if you had been in a disclosure with a certified trained therapist, maybe that's the time that you say, hey, husband, I want you to get into treatment. You know, you've now disclosed everything that's going on, and you need intensive treatment or you need to get out. You know, not that I'm encouraging partners to split, but there are times for therapeutic separations. There really are. It doesn't mean that you have to divorce, but it may mean that the partner needs to get into a program, maybe even the spouse of an addict needs to get into a program. Because, I mean, that is a devastating experience when you hear the truth and you get all the details. And I never want a partner to go through that by themselves.
Mm-hmm. Well, come to think of it, Carol, I did attend COSA meetings. It's probably been 5 years ago. But I found that the women only talked about themselves. They never talked about addiction, and nobody knew. I was trying to find out what sex addiction was. I didn't know. It's not in my realm of comprehension. I've never been in that world. I have no idea what it is. All I know is that I felt like I was in an emotionally destructive relationship.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think you're not alone. I think almost every woman who deals with that feels like they're in an emotionally destructive relationship. And in some ways, they feel like they've been living a lie their whole life, because their life has been an illusion. They didn't know what was really going on. Now they know, and they're like, who the heck did I marry, and what the heck did our marriage really mean? And
exactly.
I think you had those feelings.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
I know you did. So what did you tell our listening audience, what did you do for yourself to get healthy and to cope with your feelings and to, you know, really work on self-care and self-nurturing?
Well, I'm still working on that. We have to do that every day. But I, of course, separated myself from him and for extended periods of time. I've given him some chances since then, but I will not tolerate anger and bullying. And
you shouldn't. Well, those are good boundaries for you to have.
Oh, yeah.
No reason for you to tolerate anger and bullying, you know,
and lying. Those I'm not going to tolerate. He's not going to live in my home. And I've always set boundaries, and that's why I've always, why I feel, you know, secure in myself. Now, this has taken my security away from me just because of the fact that exactly what we discussed, that, you know, you thought you married somebody and it wasn't who you thought you married. And but I've always had boundaries and Christian values and stood by them and stood up for myself when he would become. That was another one of my questions, is why is bullying and anger always in the picture? Is it to stay hidden from real life or what?
Well, that's a good question, and I can't say that it always is in the picture, but it sounds like it was in your picture. Some addicts actually shut down their feelings, and they stop communicating, and they don't show any feelings at all. It's like they go numb. But in your situation, you're saying that your husband at times would get very angry, and kind of describe the behavior for me.
Oh, it was at anyone, at any time. At his work, at the home, with the kids, it didn't matter who it was.
Well, do you think that he was modeling an adult that, you know, he grew up with? I mean, was that like his mother or his father? Or do you believe that perhaps his anger was a barrier to keep people away from him because he had so much disgust in himself, that he was so mad at himself that it just kind of spilled over into his relationships?
Yes. I would say he was only, when a person gets angry, they're actually angry at themselves. And in order to keep distance, this is my opinion, to keep distance from that, they get angry at other people to keep distance between them.
And I would 100% agree.
And intimacy.
Oh, and intimacy, absolutely. And so I suspect that he was so angry with himself and so disgusted, and that he had a shorter fuse. He didn't like himself. He didn't like his life. He didn't like what was going on. And he took it out on everybody. And that would be my guess. You know, it would be interesting to talk to other members of your family or other members of his staff to see what their experience was. I mean, who in your community knows that your husband has a sexual addiction?
Oh, golly. You mean my friends?
Uh-huh.
Oh, I have a couple of girlfriends, some family members. Yes.
Okay.
Even my adult grown children know, and they're glad to see that Dad's getting help.
Okay. And, you know, I had talked about the fact that sometimes an addict who experiences such emotional, physical, or sexual abuse in their childhood acts out what we call eroticized rage, which means that because they experienced abuse as a kid, they actually learned that behavior, they acted out as adults, and sometimes that can actually provide them an opportunity then to justify sexual stimulation. Now, more than, I've never really believed that to be the case with your husband or with you. And I know you had some questions about eroticized rage anyway.
Yes. I wanted you to explain what eroticized rage is and what separates addicts from sex offenders.
Mm-hmm.
Or is there any difference?
Well, that's really a good question. And sex offenders may be sexual addicts or not. You know, it has to do with the compulsion and the obsession. And so you have to interview people and really identify what kind of obsession or compulsion do they have. I don't work with men who are sex offenders because that's not my field of expertise. But I know that oftentimes people that do work with sex offenders, some of them are sex addicts. They are very compulsive and obsessive, and they, you know, that's a pedophile. That is what's different about a molester, somebody who molests a kid, versus the man or woman that has to molest over and over and over again. I'm not very comfortable talking about criminal behavior because I don't know much about it.
Mm-hmm.
What I can say is that the majority of men that I work with are not sex offenders. They do have sexual addictions. And again, sex offenders can fall under sexual addiction, but not all sexual addictive clients are sexual offenders. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay. Because I did not say that very well, but there is a difference, and once again, a sexual offender may have a sexual addiction, but he or she may not. And so that has to be treated by specialists, and I'm not one of them, so I can't even say much about that. I'd be talking out both sides of my mouth.
Okay. Your phone's been breaking up all evening. Anyway, my question number five, why is there a sense of entitlement, and why the selfishness and self-centeredness of the illness? Of themselves.
Well, sexual addiction is a very selfish disorder. I mean, when somebody has a sexual addiction, they have to go into isolation. They have to remove themselves from other people, and they do not think about the consequences of their behavior on a person. What, in essence, they do is think about how it pleases them, what it reinforces in them. So when you say, why is there a sense of entitlement? Unfortunately, it goes with all addiction, whether you've got a drug addiction, an alcohol addiction, or a sex addiction. It is part of the disease of addiction. Now, what if I were going to ask you just to free associate, Charlotte, why do you think your husband, do you think he was always selfish, or do you think that it came with the disease?
In a lot of ways, he has always been selfish. In other ways, he's not. So that's a tough one to answer.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and I don't know because I did not live your life, but I can tell you that when an addict is in real recovery, they are learning how to empathize with and how to feel things from their partner's point of view. And so what you should notice in your husband is that he is beginning to try to see things from your point of view, and he should almost be putting you first as opposed to himself. It's almost a 360, that when somebody's in recovery, they work really hard at almost over-pleasing their partner.
Yes.
Because they
yes.
realize how selfish and entitled they have been. And now they're doing for their partner what they've been doing for themselves. They're putting themselves in their partner's place, and they're saying, whatever you want. I'll buy you whatever you need. I'll be home whenever you want. I'll do this for you. I'll do that for you. Because they're making amends. They're trying to right the wrong. And you've noticed that about your husband.
Yes, I have. But after 40 years of the wrongs, it's just a little hard to even believe that there is some positive change. He has a long way to go.
And that's fair.
And I pray for him. I pray for him that he does continues the work towards recovery. And he will have to stay in this program, I'm sure, his entire life.
Oh, 100%. As well as, you mentioned prayer. I mean, literally, not only is sexual addiction an issue of an intimacy disorder, but it's also a spiritual disorder. And so he should be closer to God now that he's in recovery than he's ever been before in his life. There should be more of a spiritual component to his life where he, at every turn, is asking, what would Jesus do, or what would God do, or what would my higher power do? What would my higher power want me to do? And that's the beautiful thing about the program. It really not only has him working towards getting closer to you, but he should be getting closer to his higher power. Have you noticed any of that?
He stopped going to church, I guess. But that's, maybe he goes to all these church SAA meetings and he feels like that's enough. I told him that I was too embarrassed to sit at church with him, so I choose to go to a different service, but I don't believe that he has been going to church.
Okay.
Which isn't necessary. You have to live it every day. You can't live without conscience. As a child, if I did something wrong, I had a guilty conscience and I felt bad about it, and I did everything I could do to correct it and make it right then.
Right.
If I lied to my parents, or I stole a baseball one time for my brother's birthday because I didn't have enough money and my dad found the ball,
mm-hmm.
and he'd taken me to the hardware store, and he talked to me in a very loving manner. I told him that I did steal it and from the hardware store for my brother's birthday, and I didn't have the money. I was not very old, probably 10 or 11, maybe
mm-hmm.
12, I doubt it. And he said, well, I'm going to take it back to the store and tell him what happened and return it. And that was the end of that.
Well, yeah, he modeled healthy behavior, how to right a wrong, and you learned from that experience. You didn't have to steal again. That was enough for you to know right from wrong.
Exactly.
And I get that. So tell me, you said that you were too embarrassed to go to the same church or go to church with him?
The same church with him.
Okay. And talk a little bit more about that embarrassment. What do you mean?
The embarrassment is because he has not lived a Christian life. And he has disobeyed 6 of the 10 commandments or more, and it's just unconscionable in Christ's eyes. But we're all sinners, there's no doubt. And
well,
I was embarrassed for him because I feel like I still feel a little bit like it's a reflection of me, and I should not feel that way.
Well, that's exactly right. You should not feel that way. I mean, I always talk to parents who have misbehaving children, and I say, you know, your children's misbehavior is not a reflection of your parenting. Yes, you have to come up with the proper consequences, but ultimately it's up to them to either get it or not get it. And I guess, you know, I believe that if you are married to an addict who is not working the program, who is not trying, who is not empathizing with you, that's a recipe for disaster, and that is probably not going to ever end up into a happy marriage. So what you really have to do is you have to be able to look at what is the addict doing to right the wrongs. And you really need to weigh that. And I would encourage you to write down everything he's doing to right the wrong. And then, you know, only you can decide, is that enough to keep that faith alive that maybe the two of you can work it out? You know,
okay.
Interestingly enough, in my men's group tonight, one of the men said, I am dealing with my wife's anger because I owe it to her. I owe it to her because I have hurt her so badly. And I am going, and it's not easy to stay with an angry woman when you're trying to do the right thing, but it's the least I can do for all of her pain. And he was right on target. It is the least he can do. And any good sponsor will tell his addicts, his recovering addicts, you know, try to put yourself in her shoes. How do you think she feels? She has every right to expect that of you. She has every right to be that angry. I mean, on a scale of 1 to 10, 10 being very angry, 1 being not at all angry, how angry with you? With him, are you today?
I don't believe I am angry at him. I'm more angry at myself. If that
now,
makes
why
any
would
sense.
You say that? You should never be angry with yourself.
Well, it's as long as I can keep it separate that was his problem, but it affected me and how it affects. It's when we see the addict and how their behavior can and does transcend from
mm-hmm.
generation to generation. We have a responsibility to ourselves and our children to stop the cycle, and I was too naive, I guess, or to understand that it was abnormal for a husband to look at porn. I didn't know that it involved so much more than that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So you kind of rationalized the behavior, hoping that it was just men being men, and you had no idea of how significant that behavior was or what it led up to in terms of other indiscretions and horrible, immoral choices.
No. How would you know? How would one know?
Mm-hmm. Oh, you know, I don't
think... I mean,
think...
except just, you know, signs of it and that kind of thing. But then you're told, on the other hand, oh, well, men look at porn and at pretty women and that kind of thing. So you just, you know, you don't know what to believe.
Mm-hmm. No, I know that. And, you know, I say this almost on every show, but truly, you're a pioneer in this field, as is your husband, as is myself, in that there's never been information that showed you the warning signs. There's never been help for these kinds of problems. And unfortunately, you and your husband and even myself as a therapist, we're all guinea pigs. we're all just doing the best we can, and we're learning what works and what doesn't. And 100 years from now, there will be plenty of treatment centers and treatment modalities and therapists and support groups and family supports and church supports for this kind of problem. But right now, you just kind of flew by the seat of your pants because you didn't know any better. You just did the best you could. So you can never turn that against yourself because you didn't know.
Well, I did take the problem to the journey pastor at my church. Mm-hmm. And they have started, it's called a Braveheart series, where they address, it's for men only, where they address these issues of men, you know, focusing on God and their wives, God first and then their wives, and trying to stay away from porn and lust and that kind of thing. It's to keep men Christ-focused.
Mm-hmm.
On their families and their wives and God, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Because I took March Danny to the journey pastor and sat him down and told him what was going on, and then they realized that there was a problem and that maybe the church needs to step in and help. And they are starting their second Braveheart series in September again.
Well, that's what I mean. You are a pioneer in that you and Danny have helped get that situation going. And it takes a lot of courage to be honest with what you're dealing with. And I know there's humiliation that can occur with that courage. But truly, if you can keep focused on the fact that you're doing what's right and what God would want you to do and what's right for families and community, you know, hopefully that will help heal the heart a little bit as you're feeling your own pain. Now you said I don't really feel anger is what you said, right?
But I am angry.
I was gonna say I don't know how you couldn't be.
Yes.
And so obviously, you know, you've done a lot of reading and you've talked to the right people, and I even understand that you may be considering going to some intensive treatment to help you cope with this, not because you're the sick one, but because you know that you need added support, education, and insight. Is that true?
Yes, yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, I can't commend you enough. And for anybody listening, you know, it takes a lot of courage to leave your family situation for a day, an hour, whatever, a weekend, a week, a month, and get the kind of help you need so that you can let go of some of the anger and certainly the resentment and the mistrust. And, you know, you may not be able to let go of that stuff, but at least you'll better understand what tools are available to help you cope with it.
Mm-hmm.
And you are a strong woman, and you've known that your whole life.
Yes, I've been mother and father, I'm afraid, to my husband. But I just want to tell women to please make time to listen to your soul and your gut. And if something isn't right, do something. It can't continue. We have to stop the cycle. And shame on society for the allowing the porn and the movies and the access to so many temptations that our children shouldn't be exposed to. And I just want to wish all the ladies that are listening, that may be listening tonight, and the men, the very best, and keep praying. And I don't know what more I can say this evening. I'm just a little
well, I think
you
did a good job of reminding people to keep the faith, but at the same time to stop the cycle, and that's clearly what you're working on. And I just so appreciate you coming on the air and talking so candidly about your own feelings and about your own, you know, situation. And again, you are a pioneer in this field, and so whenever you begin to feel shame or embarrassment or humiliation or confusion, know that, you know, you did the best you could with what you knew and that you're making healthy choices from here on out. And I wish you the best and, of course, we'll continue to follow you. And thank you so much for being on the show.
Well, thank you so much for having me. And Carol, I do have one more little quick question. Have you ever shared with your audience how many men may be affected, like 1 in 3, 1 in... by this disorder?
Well, no. Now, the statistics say anywhere from 4 to 7 million men are affected by this disorder. I, of course, have not seen, I have not done any stats myself personally, but my experience is 1 out of every 4 men have indiscretions that they feel great shame about. And they would like to right the wrong, and, you know, I'm helping them to do that. And some of them are sexual addicts, and some of them on that continuum are not sexual addicts, but they're heading that direction if they don't get help.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, well, you hang in there and keep giving all of the addicts and their families the support and encouragement and knowledge and information that you can, and I appreciate you taking the time to share your knowledge, and it's a learning experience for you as well.
Oh, it is. I say I'm in infancy in this. There's no doubt about it. I feel like I've learned so much and have so much more to learn. So thank you so much, Charlotte.
Thank you.
You have a great night.
Okay, you too. Thank you.
Uh-huh.
Bye-bye.
Bye. So as you can see, she's amazingly strong and definitely understands the personal pain that she and her family has experienced. And I even think she gets the pain that her husband has felt too. But she, like so many other partners, goes in and out of that because there is so much anger and sadness and hurt and betrayal and mistrust whenever there's lying, cheating, and deceit. But this is an addiction that can be healed. So I leave you with some hope, strength, and recovery. And, you know, as I say at the end of every show, there will only be one of you at all times. So I fearlessly want you to have the courage to be yourself, to seek support, and to really work hard at making your life better for yourself, your family, and your community. Have a great day. And I'll see you next week when we have Dr. Susan Kampling on talking about sexual addiction.